Coming up next on RCR, it's the dialogue with Dewa De Boer from politics.
So we sort of have a crossroads, as it were, here in New Zealand.
To power.
You know, when good men stand up, the spines of others are stiffened.
And culture.
Through times like this, you know, through adversity, you can see who you can trust, who you can rely on. You see who's standing with you, and all of these things are very, very valuable.
Tune in on Fridays, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the show at the end of another week on Reality Check Radio. I am your host, Dewa De Boer, and this is The Dialogue. This afternoon, we will be joined by Dr. John Robinson, the author of Who Really Broke the Treaty, to tell us, well, who really broke the treaty. The perspective put forward by the book isn't one that I have heard before, so I hope that you will find it enjoyable and informative. I was interviewed by Rodney Hyde on Tuesday, his Real Talk show, and he asked me, what is conservatism? It turned into quite a personal story, so I do really recommend that after the day is over here that you listen to that interview. But I've been thinking since then that I didn't really go into, while personal conservatism is about traditions, family, community, and the continuity from generation to generation to generation, that in the current political environment, conservatism is and needs to be more radical. And so the view that he used to have on conservatism is still relevant, I believe. And we sort of call this counter-revolutionary, because conservatives can't really be revolutionary. After all, we are opposed to the eternal revolution and the consequences of the French Revolution and its ideals. So Rodney's younger self, being skeptical about conservatism, was right in that conservatives failed to recognize that the order that they were supposed to be preserving was dead. We forgot what time it was. Now it's not really the time to conserve, but really to wage a counter-revolution. And this shift is happening right now with the millennial generation of conservatives, the new right, as it is sometimes called, the very online right, and sometimes other names as well, like the dissident right or the neo-reactionary right. It's very important because some of the most powerful men in the world are adjacent to this movement, if not part of it. Elon Musk, the richest man, the man in charge of a massive amount of industrial power in the form of Tesla and SpaceX, and the owner of the most influential social media site, Twitter. And another one is J.D. Vance, a name many of you may not have heard before, a U.S. senator from Ohio who authored Hillbilly Elegy and has just become the next vice president of the United States. I'll talk with William McGimsey about all of that in the context of the attempted assassination of Donald Trump during the weekly roundup near the end of the show. We'll have a little bit of time for New Zealand history and poetry with a few items from the mailbag as always, but let's get into it now with a fun piece of music. Last week I had great feedback on In the Hall of the Mountain King by Edvard Grieg, so this week I will try to keep the upbeat theme going with the March from The Nutcracker by Peter Tchaikovsky, played by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And after that, we will speak with author Dr. John Robinson about his latest book, Who Really Broke the Treaty. But first, enjoy the music.
Welcome back to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. Dr. John Robinson, who is a scientist with a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and that's the one in America. I've got a local Manukau Institute of Technology that I went to, which we refer to as MIT as well, but this is the real MIT. And Dr. Robinson has written a series of books on early New Zealand history and also on cultural and political developments in the present day. And his most recent book, Who Really Broke the Treaty, was published by Tross Publishing. And he joins us now to discuss this very topical issue. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi there.
And have you got any other background you'd like to give us on your history, your interest in the subject, how you sort of got onto writing about the treaty and other early parts of New Zealand history?
Yes, my background has quite a relevance here, I think. As a research scientist, we often come across problems where you don't know what's going on, and that's because the accepted theory just doesn't fit the facts. And then it becomes important to reach outside the accepted theory, what you're told to believe, and you have to ask questions. Now, that came up in also in the second lot of work I did in futures research, which was looking at the long-term future of the Earth. And there you gathered a huge number of facts until you're so confused it's not funny. And what was important there was to stand back and see the broad picture. So that became very important. And that enters into the further bit of work I did on social statistics for a decade or so, looking at the difference between Maori and non-Maori, and coming to the realisation that we were not measuring and discussing ethnicity, we were looking at class differences. And that was very, very clear in 1984, because after the move of Maori into the cities, just after the Second World War, conditions improved for many Maori. The difference in life expectancy, Maori and non-Maori, had been 20 years in 1940, and it had dropped steadily down to be 5 years in 1984. And that would have disappeared by the year 2000. There'd be no difference by now if that trend had kept on. But the trend was broken by the huge change in government policy under Rogernomics, which introduced an underclass and increased inequalities tremendously. And the Maori, who'd become largely members of the working class, suffered, and that difference in life expectancy went from that 5 years up to 9 years and settled down to about seven. So what is clear is that a lot of the problems that are there today are due to political decisions, nothing to do with colonisation. By the way, I've followed that sort of trend of being free to think for myself, and that brings about conclusions which are considered controversial. And in today's world, you're not allowed to be controversial or ask questions. So I don't fit in very well.
I can understand that. We have that at Reality Check Radio. We're all people who don't fit in to the accepted narrative and like to ask questions. It's interesting you mentioned what you thought was a class issue, not an ethnic issue. And I was just thinking about the fact that our government has now, the largest number of ministers of Maori descent. But they're all, very well off. It's interesting to see, that distinction has occurred. And it's largely a class-based distinction between what you see in the Labour Party Maori caucus, what you see in the Maori Party, very much poor working class, as you mentioned, and then the support and ministers that are of Maori descent in the government, more well-off, affluent people. So it's not really an ethnic problem, as you say.
And the leadership in the Maori group, since we are talking race, because race is very important to New Zealand, not to me, but to New Zealand, they're mostly the well-off Maori who've, the Maori elite, as it's referred to often, who've got a great deal out of treaty settlements and jobs for the boys and so on. Can I get on to where the treaty comes in here? Because all my work on statistics, there was no mention of the treaty ever in any of that. But I came across that around 2000 when some of my work was for the Crown Forestry Rental Trust. And I was suggesting that the Maori had not suffered terribly from the wrongs of colonialism, but had benefited considerably. And I'd simply had to rewrite it. So I had to find out what was this treaty business that was directing all the research and meant that I couldn't take part in it. I was told I couldn't understand Maori, and particularly the old Maori, and I decided to test that one by trying to understand Tamaki Wakanini, a killing chief, you know, a warrior, who became a friend of government and a peacemaker and so on, as was Te Wharewhera, the first Maori king. So I found, yes, we can understand one another. They're all real people, just like us. And by taking that sort of stance, I become one of the people who've been labelled as racist. So I asked myself, okay, what are you talking about? What is racist? I'm calling for equality. Well, I've got a simple definition of racism, which is, first of all, to believe in race. Now, a Maori in New Zealand law is a member of the New Zealand race, so that's the first thing to establish, that race is written into New Zealand law. Second step, to measure people by race, to divide them, and that's carried out in New Zealand all the time, separate parties, separate seats, and so on. And thirdly, to give different treatment to different races, and that's carried out in New Zealand. So there's my definition of racism, by which definition New Zealand is racist.
And yeah, that's a very interesting way to put it. And so what was it that really got you to write this book, Who Really Broke the Treaty, and other books that you've written covering the treaty? And what's the prime thesis of the book? What's it really about in a short summary?
Well, the next step was to ask the forbidden question, who really broke the treaty? Because we're told, and the Waitangi Tribunal was set up to establish this, that the Crown and the Crown alone broke the treaty against the Maori. So I decided to take an independent look at it and just say, okay, what is it to break the treaty? Who is it that might have broke the treaty? And to have a good look at that.
And so what are the actual obligations then that the Treaty of Waitangi put on each side in 1840?
Well, the first point is all people involved in the treaty took on obligations. That, of course, includes the Maori who signed the treaty. They said, we'll stick to this. Now, most Maori welcomed the treaty. In fact, that was shown quite dramatically at Waitangi. On the Wednesday, the treaty was presented. The treaty, by the way, was written by English, by the British, was translated into Maori by the British. So you can't write the British out of the consideration of what the treaty is and what it means. But that was on the Wednesday. And on the Thursday, Hobson thought he'd have a day off and they'd come back on the Friday and go on for a week or so of discussion. But Friday morning, the chiefs turned up and said, we want to sign the treaty. So we've got to understand the treaty was desired by Maori. They wanted it. It was part of a huge Maori cultural transformation that went from probably 1830 to 1850, where Maori moved from tribal warfare, cannibalism, female infanticide and slavery to a British system of justice. So it was a huge change where they moved from their tikanga, and the chiefs on that day showed how keen they were to sign that treaty, and that attitude was shown in further discussions amongst Maori who were very welcoming of both the coming of law and the coming of Christianity. As a non-Christian, I can see the benefit that Christianity brought to the Maori at that time. And above all, it gave a picture of all people as having some equality across the world.
And a very key element here as well with the missionaries is that they were invited to come by the Maori, by the chiefs, to set up mission stations, to set up schools, from the especially during the 1820s and 30s, I believe. They did a lot of work up and down the North Island, and you know, they were heavily involved as well in encouraging the Treaty of Waitangi as being something that would have a very positive impact on Maori who were trapped in this cycle of warfare, of utu, that would go on and on
And the missionaries worked very, very hard to break that. And they made a lot of progress, you know, with, you know, in, because many Maori themselves desired that. You know, they were sick of this.
There's so many people to admire in our history. Our history is presented today as one of wrongs and wrongdoing and so on. There were great people doing fantastic things. And this was the meeting of two very different people. The Maori were had come across the Pacific over 3,000 years. So for 3,000 years, Polynesians had been separated from the vast mass of humanity across the Eurasian landmass. And during the time that the city-state had developed and philosophies and so on, they were quite separated. Yet they got together, they discussed. Not only were Maori prepared to sit down and talk to Maori, Maori talked to the missionaries too. So it was a great exchange.
Something I found on reading more about early New Zealand history as well as how intelligent the Maori were considered, how, you know, how well they could, how quickly they learned things, how quickly they adapted. And they worked very well side by side with the missionaries. And in the end, after the treaty was signed then, the obligations and that, you know, we'd need to talk a little bit more about, because how were these obligations broken then? You've asked who really broke the treaty. Well, you know, who were the first ones to kind of start to realize that, you know, they didn't really want to put up with their side of the deal?
Well, first of all, the treaty gave the right to govern, and British law prevailed thereafter, made so very clear by Aparana Ngata writing about the Maori treaty in 1922. So the treaty involved simply setting up a system and a structure by which decisions and judgments would be made by the proper authorities. So it was no longer by chiefly might, not just the chief could decide, I don't like you, bang, you're dead type of thing. So we've got a couple of points. All parties had signed up to that and could be considered to have broken it. And secondly, and this is particularly important, should the new authority make a judgment that we don't like today, that wasn't to break the treaty. We can't sit in judgment. They were dealing with a difficult situation. And to break the treaty is simply to move outside of a proper way of governing, not to be perfect in every decision. So shall I move on to a few representative examples of breaking of the treaty? Because that was the next step I had to take. Who broke the treaty? Now, I dealt with it rather briefly in the book, about seven examples, giving an idea. You could do a huge tomes on that if you want, if you set up a Waitangi tribunal to look at all breaches of the treaty, but that hasn't been done. And here's just three of them. First of all, the Wairau massacre of 1843, when Te Rapa and Rangi Hayata killed 11 defenceless prisoners. Now, the original fighting was as much the blame of the settlers and the British as of the Maori. They got into a fight, but because the Maori were still coming out of tribalism, their fighting was pretty brutal. They took prisoners and killed 11 who were then defenceless. Now, that killing was a breach of the treaty. It was against the law. It was a breach of the treaty. Now, Fitzroy decided not to punish them. Now, in my judgment, Fitzroy did a terrible wrong, but he was not breaking the treaty because he was given that authority. That's what the treaty set up, that authority. Now, a second example is what happened in North Taranaki in 1859 and 1860, because we go back in the history. In the 1820s, the Taranaki people had been driven out of their lands by the Waikato, killed. Some were taken prisoner as slaves back to Waikato. Some escaped and came down to where I am now in Kapiti and killed the people living here, drove them out, took their land. You can see how war leads to war all the time. But however, after the peace had been made, they were able to move back home. And the people from Waikanae took with them some feuds. They were very argumentative people. And in particular, some wanted to sell some land and some said, you're not going to do that. So the feuds had killed about 50 people and it was lawlessness across northern Taranaki. So the governor, Gore Brown, went there in 1859 and said, okay, it's time to bring law to this area, to bring peace. And immediately some of them said, does that mean we can sell our land? And he had to say yes, and they showed that they owned the land. And so it was sold, and immediately the king, the chief, the main chief, Kingy, he decided he wouldn't allow that. So he set up a fort, and so war started. That was rebellion, and that was a breach of the treaty by Kingy. You'll notice that the British were trying very hard to see both sides of questions and settle things as best they could. That's what the rule of law is about. A third example is that in 1857 and 1858, there were big meetings in the Waikato to suggest setting up a king. Most Waikato Maori refused. That is not well known, but most Maori in the Waikato said, no, we don't want your king. Your king says we can't sell our land. He's going to bully us and tell us what we can and can't do. And we're quite satisfied with the government we've got now. So the Kingites went away and appointed poor old Te Whirawhira. He was in the last year and a half of his life, an old man, and pretended he was a king. And that led on to war. The setting up of a rival monarch and a rival territory was definitely a breach of the treaty. It was treason, and that was properly punished, and there was nothing wrong with confiscating some land as a result of rebellion. So we have several examples there in which the people who broke the treaty were Maori. And the people who suffered were the settlers who were moved out of the areas in northern Taranaki, for example, Waitara, where the settlers had been told, yes, you can settle here, and they'd been moved. That happened on two occasions. So there was a lot of suffering. And so here's my conclusion. The Crown, the civil governors, and the government never broke the Treaty of Waitangi. All actions taken were in accord with the accession of sovereignty and the assertion of British law. And to repeat again, that didn't guarantee that the decisions would be completely what are satisfactory to today's Maori Party. And a number of Maori chiefs and their iwi committed acts of treason and rebellion in contradiction to the Treaty of Waitangi. So that's the challenge I'm making. That's my analysis.
And your analysis is completely at odds with modern academia. So why is it then that only the Crown is deemed capable of treaty breaches by modern lawyers and academics?
Because that's the way it was set up in 1975 under the insistence of Matt Rata, a member of the Labour government at the time. And so that was to consider only claims of wrongdoing by the Crown against Maori, as you've said. His aim became pretty clear because he wanted more and more and more, and he then got dissatisfied with the Labour government, wouldn't give him all he wanted, and he left and set up his own party, Mana Motuhake, which wanted to have a separate government, which is a similar to the It's an echo of a bill for Kotahitanga brought before Parliament by Honeheke Napua in 1894. These ideas have been around amongst the minority of Maori and have been turned down time and time again. And the process that has now been set up is worth having a look at because we have, first of all, the Treaty of Waitangi is labelled as a sacred document. We have to follow it. We can't change a word of it, and the meaning of it can only be defined by current Maori leadership. It's as if the British, the English, all the rest of us are written out of that. And that is a naked power grab. It's a weapon for taking over much of the government. And you can see that in the description of the prescription in Hei Pūapua, a report. I've written a book on that, a report to government, which suggests that we must head by 2030. Sorry, I've got that. It was 2040. 2040, their vision 2040. Towards two separate governments, two separate sets of laws, complete institutional apartheid is what is proposed in an end to democracy and equality. That's the did you think I'm saying something a bit extreme? Because I'm quoting from documents. I'm quoting from Hei Pūapua. I'm not just making it up. I'm quoting from a Te Kei Mai and other reports. If you'd listen to what is being said, that is the aim now.
I've read those government reports, and definitely this is not something you're making up. Everyone who's read those reports knows that that's what's in them. There are some conservatives even who perhaps say, look, the second article of the treaty especially sort of seems to guarantee some kind of lower level of authority and territorial integrity to Maori that maybe wasn't upheld. Do you have a response to that, to say that the treaty perhaps it could rightly be interpreted as allowing some kind of perhaps like devolved powers, local powers of local government over their territories to Maori? Is there something like that that you see as a fair argument, or is that just, again, a modern mind's reading into the treaty, something that was never there?
If you follow it a bit, you'll see that the meaning of words has changed over time, so that the property was defined as property taken at the point of a spear by Hongi Hika back in the 1820s, and it's now become treasures. It's been anything and everything. You can see the point there I'm making, that the only people who are now allowed to interpret the treaty are the separatists. You see, that is their claim. That must be refuted. And the three parts of the treaty, first of all sovereignty goes to the Crown, and at the moment it has been ruled in the Supreme Court and by the Waitangi Tribunal that the sovereignty is in the hands of iwi and hapu, so that is a contrary to the treaty completely. And the third is that we're all equal, we're all British. And the second one is perhaps a little unclear, but it was challenged once by the British, who claimed terra nullius, and that is not made clear in the second article, which land remains in Maori control. But the argument there was settled in favour of Maori. All unsettled land belongs to Maori. So I guess that comes to your next question, which was, what relevance should the treaty have today, which is kind of important. And my answer is very simple, none whatsoever. The treaty has been stripped of all meaning. It's now claimed that it means the opposite to the original. It's used as a weapon for dividing us. So it should be set aside. And there's a far more important question to consider. What sort of society do we today want here in New Zealand today?
And that society is full of many different kinds of people. I guess we have a very multicultural society today, whether we like it or not. And the situation before us is basically one of, do we have effectively two different classes of people in New Zealand, or do we have a single united society with one law that governs all of us together?
That's my point, yes. Well put.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And we are nearly out of time here, so I just wanted to ask you if you've got other books that you've written that you might want to mention or recommend. I could already say the Tross Publishing
If you go through to the website, trosspublishing.com, there's a long list of books that you've written there. Are there any in particular that you might want to recommend to people?
Well, I will leap in with a couple. Hey, Poor Poor, it's basic. Everybody should read that and should have read the Hey, Poor Poor report. I've written a book early on in the New Zealand experience just describing the meeting of two very different people, because Maori and non-Maori were very different back then in 1800 and so on. And thirdly, the Kingite Rebellion. And I mention that because it's a thick book that looks at all the background to the King movement and the rebellion then, and carrying it towards today.
Well, thank you for that. And that was Dr. John Robinson, who has written a series of books on early New Zealand history. Thank you very much for joining us. And to the audience, we will be right back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or even if you don't agree with what you're hearing, you can get in touch with us by texting us your message at 2057. That's 2057. Or if you'd rather email us, you can at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so get in touch with us now.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Diwa Dabor.
Well, that is an angle from author John Robinson that you do not hear much, and I think it is an important one. If the British governor had the right and the duty to govern, to make laws, to judge over disputes, then the rebellions against that government must automatically be breaches of the Treaty of Waitangi. It doesn't mean that the government was perfect, and it very well might and does make bad and wrong decisions, but what a crime it has been for New Zealand's great history to be framed as a list of treaty breaches by the Crown. His reference to the Wairau massacre was timely. We covered that exactly a month ago on this show, if you've been paying attention. Else, I certainly would not have had much of a clue as to what he was talking about. So it's really great to talk about New Zealand history. And I should also mention that Dr. Robinson wrote an excellent book on the musket wars called Unrestrained Slaughter, which I am reading at the moment. Now it is time for This Week in New Zealand History. On the 20th of July, 1892, the Wellington and Manawatu Railway Company's steam locomotive number 10 set the world speed record for the narrow gauge, averaging 68 kilometers per hour on a two-hour run and hitting a top speed of 103 kilometers per hour. High speeds were rare on New Zealand railways, and this performance was equal to some of the best standard gauge English express trains of the era. Our trains used to run on time and with excellent service, which has long been taken from us. This record-breaking run was celebrated by the railway fireman and poet William Lawson in his poem Big Bull Yank. Now hear the sound of her hard exhaust as her weight leans on the train. There's a heavy roar as the bridge is crossed and she's free on the plain. Where the flax leaves gleam in the autumn sun, you can hear the great wheels romp. She's breaking her heart for a record run by the Tokomaru Swamp. Earlier in the week, and later in history, on the 14th of July 1950, marked the death of Sir Apiranannata, one of the great statesmen of the early 20th century, and an early figure on Maori nationalism and biculturalism in New Zealand. He worked to improve Maori social and economic conditions, spent nearly four decades in Parliament. He became the native minister in 1928 and worked on Maori land development. He was sceptical of appeals to the Treaty of Waitangi as a way to address grievances and presciently warned, and I quote, "I say, be careful lest you waken the legal experts of the Pākehā people who will say, Let them have what they are asking for. Let the purport of the treaty be exercised to the very end. Put the same levies on the Māori as are levied on the Pākehā." End quote. And we are not quite there yet, but for good or ill, we are quickly marching towards the equality that the treaty demands. Now it is time for the weekly roundup with William McGimpsey, and there is a lot to talk about, so I've allocated him some extra time. But first, let's listen to the Winterlied by the Austro-Bohemian romantic composer Gustav Mahler, sung by Bernarda Fink with Antoni Spiri on piano.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Diwa de Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio. It is the 29th week of the year, and what a week it has been. Welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Diwa. It's good to join you again.
And we have been starting with international news recently, but there's really only one piece of international news that has trumped all other pieces of international news and domestic news as well. And that happened nearly a week ago now. And so we can, I guess, reflect on how it's developed a little bit as well. But the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump took place Sunday New Zealand time or Saturday in America, I believe. And it was pretty close, wasn't it?
Yep. They got him in the ear, and he only just tilted his head just in time to avoid the bullet. The thing he was looking at was, of course, a poster illustrating the very high immigration rates, the border crossing, an immigration poster. So his focus on immigration in that instant literally saved his life.
Yes, for those of you who have been on social media, particularly Twitter. I don't know if there are other places where this has been posted, but there is basically a sort of 3D reconstruction of the path of the bullets and Trump moving his head. And it was, you know, just 0.3 seconds and a few centimeters away from death. He just moved his head right as the bullet came past and it clipped his ear. It's quite a miraculous thing. Divine intervention, I would say. And I've definitely seen other people attribute things like the wind. There was a little bit of a crosswind, but that counts as divine intervention. So I'll chalk it up to that.
Yeah, and what his reaction was the perfect reaction politically. I mean, we should just say that this is a terrible thing that's happened. America has been known to have assassinations and assassination attempts of its presidents, but it's a terrible thing that's happened. But I just wanted to premise with that because I'm just going to say the way Trump reacted to the assassination attempt was a perfect political reactions, perfect political instincts. He stood up, he told his security detail to wait, and then he clenched his fists, raised it in the air, said, "Fight, fight, fight," and the crowd cheered as he walked away. And the photos that were taken off the back of that incident were spectacular, and they're going to live in America. It's going to be a big part of America's political history, I think, moving forward. People will never forget that. His reaction in particular has had the effect of, I think, at this point, it looks like galvanizing support behind him and making his election. It's still a wee while away. Other things can still happen, but it seems like it's making his re-election very likely.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a bad development in politics in America. You did say that it has happened a few times before in America, and certainly not the first time that a candidate or a president has been shot in America. But yeah, it's particularly with regards to Trump, it's been a very, very bad development, I would say, because the way that he's been framed as being the enemy of democracy, the sort of the ultimate evil threat. He's been described continually by him as an existential threat to the country. And so, yeah, an attempted assassination puts the American political sphere in a very difficult place, especially in the past where assassinations or attempted assassinations have sort of resulted in galvanizing the entire country, say, behind a particular candidate, and you've seen landslide elections and so on. This still looks like it's going to be close. It's almost like it doesn't change anybody's mind. It's like, oh yeah, you know, candidate just got shot, and instead of it changing the outcome into a massive landslide, you might still just see a very close, a close swing, like a very small swing towards Trump instead of, say, 10 points and maybe 1 or 2 points. And that may be enough to secure his victory, but just the point of no return almost that American politics has reached, and whether we can say it has reached that point or it's nearly reached that point, some people may say that we're well beyond that point now, and but that certainly is very concerning. And I was talking with Brendan Malone about this, about republics having a shelf life, and republics tend not to live very long before they dissolve. And it feels a little bit like the American Republic is in its late stage.
Yes. I mean, this is the issue, right? People need to have something in common when all the political differences are said and done and put aside. There needs to be some sort of shared culture, shared values, shared traditions, shared religion that holds the people together and makes the political differences not an existential problem, not a matter of friend and foe, but a matter of a disagreement over correct public policy. And this is the problem in America and most of the other Western liberal democracies at the moment, is that the range of political views, the spectrum of political views is so big, and that the view of the good life that the different parts of this society have, that people on the right and the people of the left, they have such different views of, you know, the role of government, the role of society, what the good life looks like, that they're diametrically opposed. And for one to have their way would necessarily mean the extinction of the culture and the way of life of the other. And so that's just too broad a range of differing worldviews to live together within the same society. And I think that this is a good, avoiding this sort of thing happening in the first place is one of the reasons why nationalism is sort of necessary, because it's too great a range of, you know, different views on the good life, different views on how society should be structured, different, you know, philosophical and religious systems, for them all to live together into the same country or under the same system. So we need to have a diversity of systems and a world governed by a array of sovereign states allows for that diversity of different systems to exist. And so it allows for a greater range of human societies and human types to coexist. This is one of the most important arguments for nationalism, I think. But the key point and my key takeaway from the the Trump assassination attempt is a sort of meta-political takeaway. So for a long time, we've been used to, you know, people on the left having mainstream media dominance, and they're always able to frame the, you know, rhetorical tensions rising as being driven by people on the right. And so, Trump is blamed by mainstream media for raising rhetorical tensions. And it's never the left-wing people who are calling him, you know, racists and sexists and xenophobes and homophobes and all the words, or far right, or, you know, extremist. They never hold themselves accountable. They're never held accountable for raising the rhetorical tensions by using those labels. But that is really, I think, what probably drove the shooter. We don't know that for sure, and it's speculative. But I think it's a wee bit coincidental that a lot of the details of the shooter remain unavailable to us. And I think that's could probably be caused by the fact that he was radicalized basically by the mainstream media, as a lot of people in our contemporary society are, against ideas that really aren't that far right or aren't that extreme. Yet they are labeled far right.
Everybody believed these things 5 minutes ago. These are things everybody believed until just the last few years, the last few decades, and the mainstream media has completely rewritten what are normal things and what normal things people are allowed to believe.
Yeah, and they label this sort of thing stochastic terrorism when, you know, people on Twitter or other individuals do it. What they're doing is they're systematically raising the tensions in society by the way they're framing their political foes as radical and dangerous and extreme, that it makes violent events like this much more likely to occur. And that's what they've done for a half a century now with political correctness. They've systematically sought to delegitimize the conservative half of the political spectrum, the conservative worldview, by demonizing it with all these politically correct labels as racist, sexist, homophobe, extreme, far right, radical extremist. And that rhetorical strategy is having its predictable result in tearing society apart and making these acts of violence more likely. What political correctness really is, in my view, is it's an anti-traditional and anti-Western set of moral and cultural norms that are being imposed on our society in a top-down way in order to delegitimize and demoralize the normal traditional views. So if you think that the man should be the head of the household, that's sexism, you know, and if you adhere to traditional religious views on homosexuality being immoral, then that you're a homophobe. If you are a patriot and you take your own nation's side, then you're a racist and you're a xenophobe. And on it goes with all these words. All these words delegitimize the normal, traditional, conservative views and values and intuitions of ordinary people. It's the opposite of free speech. It's the opposite of free and open debate, of discussing your differences and coming to a resolution. It's a rhetorical strategy designed to delegitimize, demonize, and shut people up. And it results in violence if you do that systematically and you control all of the media. So I condemn the mainstream media across the Western world for doing this systematically for 50 years. You've torn the greatest societies in the world apart. You're inciting violence. You need to put a stop to doing things this way.
Speaking about ordinary conservative people, I should mention at this point as well that the attempted assassination of Trump did result in the actual murder of one of the members of the crowd. And there's a man by the name of Corey Contemporator, and he was killed while protecting his family, shielding them with his body. And he was hit by the shooter, and there were several others who were injured critically, but Corey was the one who was killed. And the crowd on the whole as well stayed relatively calm. Most of them ducked for cover. They ducked to cover their family and their loved ones. And as you mentioned, you know, when Trump raised his fist and yelled fight and so on, the crowd stood up with him as well. And they were there even when they were being shot at. The ordinary conservatives of rural America stayed calm under, you know, what would be the most intense pressure and chaos. And that was, I think, quite commendable. And you could see it in the man who was killed, that's the kind of ordinary people who were there for Trump, and those are his supporters. That's his base, these family men who would, you know, take a bullet for their loved ones.
Yeah, everything we know about the man who was killed suggests that he was a very good father and a very good person. And he died, from what we understand, trying to defend his family. So, I mean, there's nothing more noble than that. And it's a very sad thing that he had to die. But yeah, this is it's an interesting point. I think Trump reacted with physical courage, and as the crowd did, as you say. But Trump's whole political career has been characterized by sort of a different sort of courage. It's the courage to say things that are unsayable. It's the courage to go against the grain. The courage to say what needed to be said, to take a risk, a political risk, and to do it despite all the wise heads and all the consultants, all the political strategists, all the upper classes being against those things being said. And he did it, and it needed to be said, and he got elected off the back of it. He's likely going to be elected again. And regardless of whether Trump is actually able to implement the policy agenda that he's set out, I mean, I hope he is able to, but even if he hasn't, his lasting legacy will be that he's acted like a bulldozer to political correctness, and he's allowed us to say things that were rendered unsayable, but that needed desperately to be said in order to point out, discuss, and solve important problems that are happening in society.
You've already hinted at a little bit of sort of coalescence around Trump, especially from his own side, his own base, is that the broader Republican Party has really come behind him after this assassination attempt. But when it comes to the elites, there have been a few who have come out publicly and endorsed him. Now, Elon Musk, I believe, was the first to say that he openly endorsed Trump. And then you had a number of other sort of people who were in a similar group to Elon Musk, and a number of these men who started PayPal are incredibly wealthy, and we'll get back to them in a minute. But it was, I believe, David Sachs and the Winklevoss twins and Anderson as well, and a few others whose names escape me at the moment. But you had all of these very, very wealthy men, some of the richest men in America, billionaires from Silicon Valley. So the new billionaires were those who got rich after the year 2000, and they're looking to shape America. And they have come out now behind Trump as kind of a counter-revolution, a counter-elite, who are willing to say, we support Trump, we'll give him the funding, we'll bankroll the personnel who could make a difference. And it seems like Trump's personnel issues are basically going to be resolved, or at least there are very important people, very intelligent people who are solving this problem now that Trump has had with personnel, and they're lining up people to fill the roles and to clear out the bureaucracy. And it seems especially these new billionaires, these younger billionaires who basically want to get more stuff done. And currently in America, they see that things are broken. The bureaucracy is so bad. The diversity programs are so bad that they can no longer get the technological progress that they want. And these guys are sort of futurists. They want to go boldly into the future. They want to conquer the solar system. They, some of them are pursuing transhumanism and so on, which I definitely don't endorse, but I'm just giving you a picture of people who are pushing for technological progress. And they're seeing that the social progress, as it were, is getting in the way. And they're now coming in very strongly behind Trump in the wake of this assassination attempt.
Yeah. Well, what Trump is really trying to do is lead a sort of a revolution of sorts, a revolution against the status quo.
We'll call it a counter-revolution. That's the conservative way to refer to it. We're not revolutionaries, but we're counter-revolutionaries.
I like your way better. That's right. And, you know, as I've discussed with you before, you know, power is not equally distributed amongst all members of society. Power is distributed according to a bell curve, and there are always people in society who have more power and people who have less. It's very difficult to overturn the norms and the institutions and the systems of governance and institute a new status quo in society if you've got none of the elite on your side. And Trump, it seemed in 2016 when he ran, had very few of other powerful and important individuals and groups in America on his side. And still now, that you would have to say that the bulk of the power structure is against him. But there is a faction of the power structure now which is supporting Trump. And Elon Musk is the richest man in the world, and he owns, I'm not sure if how you would characterize Twitter, but it's one of the most important communication platforms in the world. And the other people as well. But with Twitter, with a lot of the money that's behind him, with important people in important positions, it makes it much more likely that he's able to successfully implement his program of reform. A large part of success in implementing any program of reform is having the right people in the right places. And so he's got some important allies and important stations, positions of power within society that can help him. And hopefully they can help him turn the small number of positions of power they have into a larger and greater numbers. And that's the Heritage Foundation's 2025 plan, I believe. They want to replace large parts of the staffing of the bureaucracy with people friendly to Trump's policy agenda. Trump has distanced himself from that program, but I'm hoping.
That was before he got shot.
Well, what I'm hoping there is that's a political maneuver and doesn't necessarily represent his real feelings about it. I think one of the problems in Trump's first term was that he was obstructed by members of his own party and by members of the non-political.
He's notoriously bad staffing. Trump is notoriously bad at picking people. And so basically, okay, we've had 8 years. Have we fixed that problem? And that's it seems to be a, well, we're about to find out if that problem has been fixed.
There are people who look as if they've put a lot of thinking and work and preparation into that, including the Heritage Foundation, this Project 2025. So let's hope that that is the case.
Now, as we've already mentioned, it's been nearly a week and we know very little in terms of details about this assassination attempt as well. Why was the Secret Service so bad? Basically, as I understand it now, we know for sure that the shooter was basically identified 30 minutes before he opened fire by members of the public, and the roof that he shot from was left open by the Secret Service Department, and the lady who ran the Secret Service protection for Trump basically said that she had identified it as a health and safety concern for her people to be on the roof, something strange like that. I mean, what was going on with the Secret Service detail? And there seemed to be quite a few small women on the team who are about half the size of Trump as well, which is a little bit hard to actually be a bodyguard for someone if you're half their size. Just lots of very, very strange things going on with the Secret Service that have enabled, I guess, a lot of conspiracy theories. I don't really blame people for coming up with dozens of different conspiracy theories about this because it's just so odd.
I can't explain all these things either, but I do know that Trump's team had been requesting additional security. I mean, he's doing a lot of rallies and he's doing a lot of public events and his security team is working very hard. He'd been asking for additional security. And I read that on the day of this particular rally, that Biden chose to divert some of the security resources to his wife instead, who was giving a speech in Pennsylvania as well, leaving Trump's security team even more understaffed. So that's not a good look. But I can't explain all these things. I have no coherent theory about why all these things are happening. I'm left to speculate just the same as everyone else is.
I do like Scott Adams' reaction to it, or his reaction to all the theories were, don't underestimate the power of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's very, very possible that they simply just DEI'd themselves into this horrific situation that was so incompetent that the reason we don't know why things went wrong is just because they don't know why things went wrong, because or they do know and they're covering it up because it's part of their program to achieve equality in the Secret Service and so on. So it's weaponized incompetence seems to be the simplest explanation. Of course, there are a lot more complicated, more convoluted, more sinister theories, but at least the one that I would put forward as just being the simplest is that it was weaponized incompetence.
Well, the DEI discussion, I think, is a good one and a necessary one to come out of this. It's not to say that women security guards or women security personnel can never be good and competent, but in general, they are likely to be less suited to those sorts of roles as men. They don't possess the same size, strength. Men are built hormonally for courage and aggression more than women are. So it's less likely that women are going to have those sorts of qualities to, you know,
I can already
fire and dive on the on the president. And
I can already confirm your theories and your hypothesis here, because at the national convention, I kept a close eye on his security detail, and he had a dozen men who were larger than him, the largest men I've ever seen in my life.
Well, he's 6'3", so that'd have to be quite tall.
Oh, yeah. And so his security team has been beefed up, and they've cleared out all these little – and there were some smaller guys as well. And, you know, if you watch the video, like his security team was – I was just surprised by how small some of those guys were on his team. And that has been completely fixed in the space of 24 hours. And every single guy on his security team is at least a couple of inches taller and wider than he is.
Well, that would put me out of that job. I mean, I don't know how tall you are, but I mean, I'm 5 foot.
I'm just shy of 6 feet two. Sorry, I'm actually short. Unfortunately, people often will say, "Oh, why do you're so tall?" I said, "Well, actually, that's only because I'm in New Zealand. In the Netherlands, I'm about 2 inches shy of average height." That's just
the Dutch are the tallest people in the world.
People in the world, yeah. So you have to be quite tall to be average in the Netherlands. But getting to the national convention and the pick for vice president, which I believe was very, very important for Trump, and especially, as I would call it, assassination insurance to make sure nobody tries again. He had to pick someone who the mainstream media would be even more afraid of. So who could be more dangerous than Trump? And he picked a man by the name of J.D. Vance, James Vance. And I think very few people outside of the terminally online circles will have really heard of him. Like, I was very much aware of who he is and why he's so important. But do you have an explanation for listeners who perhaps have never heard of J.D. Vance, sort of explain why he might be picked by Trump and why the people on the new right, people on the online right, like myself, are very much in favor of this pick?
Well, Trump talks a lot about the forgotten men and women. And J.D. Vance literally wrote the book on the forgotten men and women. It's a book called Hillbilly Elegy, and it documents his experience growing up in sort of a rural small town, Kentucky and Ohio. He was raised by his grandparents in sort of poor, impoverished, ruralish white communities. And the story documents a lot of the poverty and social pathologies like drug use and stuff that were really harming those communities. And it's not an overtly political book. It's more just a sort of personal book looking at the social pathologies. But what some of the conclusions that you can sort of, extrapolate out of that, the effects of deindustrialization in the American heartland, the effects of some of the other policies, the stripping of human capital, the best and brightest out of these communities, and the incursion of many of the same social pathologies that plagued inner city black communities into these poor rural white communities. And so in a way, although the book is really just a sort of a personal reflection, not a book on public policy per se, but in a way it documents how the sort of mainstream liberal policy consensus of the past, 30, 40 years has really, or longer perhaps, has harmed some of those communities. So the free trade, for example, the overemphasis on free trade has led to the deindustrialization of the American heartland, taking away those jobs. And of course, you need jobs to have incomes, to have, a reasonable material standard of living and reasonable quality of life. A standard trade analysis of what happens when you open up, when you engage in, or you go from a closed economy to an open economy, a trade deal with another country, is that the workers in the poorer country benefit because the capital migrates to the poorer country to take advantage of the cheaper labor. But the entrepreneurs and the investor class, the wealthy in your own country benefit because they're the ones with the capital who are doing the investing in the other country. So it results in an impoverishment of your own workers and an enrichment of your own investors, so worsening inequality within your country and helping the workers in your enemy's country, well, not necessarily your enemy, but in your trading partner's country. This is literally what has happened with China. You've exported the industrial base to China. Your own workers got poor, but your wealthy investors became very rich. And so the economic and trade models that economists had for forecasting what would happen forecasted exactly that before they did it. And so that's why when they made these arguments that they always had to be accompanied by a redistribution program that would take some of the benefits that accrued to the investor class and then redistribute them to the workers to make the deal fair for everyone, to make sure everyone benefited. But of course, the same people who argue for free trade also argue against these very redistribution programs that are necessary in order to justify free trade as a way of improving living standards for the broader community rather than just the wealthy few. So workers in the American heartland have been cheated. That's been a big issue for him, renegotiating some of these free trade deals, taking on China, and trying to reinvigorate American manufacturing. And so there's a big, there's a lot in common between J.D. Vance and Donald Trump in that area. But there's more to J.D. Vance than that as well. I mean, he's also a skeptic of mass immigration. He wants to close the border up. And a problem that Charles Murray talks about in his book, Coming Apart, is that the problem of the elites in Western societies, because of the ethic of tolerance, they no longer pass judgment on bad behavior of other people in society in order to try and, you know, those soft social sanctions are really needed in order to stop people engaging in behaviors that hurt themselves, such as drug use and having children outside wedlock and all those sorts of things. And the sort of ethic of tolerance amongst our current elite, it means that the inculcation of those cultural and moral and religious norms can't happen. The way Charles Murray puts it is our elites no longer preach what they practice, because, you know, many in the higher strata of society still tend to get married and stay married longer. They go to school, they study, they don't do drugs as much. So that is another part, that the ethic of liberal tolerance cuts against leadership and being a sort of a moral stalwart in your own community and promoting good, healthy values. And that's another factor here.
It's something I often like to point out for people, is to say the elites, the wealthy, they often will live sort of personally, privately conservative lives, and that they get married, they raise children, they keep, you know, they look after their family, and they try and build, you know, close communities and focus on safety and security for those that they love. And then, but then they promote all of the liberal policy, the ideology that they promote. If when that's adopted by the people below them, it makes it impossible for those people to ever attain to what it is that the elites have, what they're officially promoting. So there's that contradiction where they're cannibalizing their own society by promoting the very values that destroy the classes beneath them.
Yeah, I mean,
don't practice those at all, ever.
Yeah, we've heard the idea of pulling the ladder up economically. This is like pulling the ladder up socially or culturally or morally. You know, the words of our leaders and the actions of our leaders and the example of our leaders are important in shaping the behavior of the wider mass of society. And people need to have a sense, if you're in a position of leadership or power or influence in society, you need to have a sense of what used to be called noblesse oblige to make sure that you are doing and saying and setting the right example for other people to encourage them to engage in healthy healthy behaviors rather than unhealthy ones.
Now, you hinted a little bit at why Trump would pick J.D. Vance, because he potentially will help, or he likely will help with that Rust Belt strategy. And if we look at the 2020 results, if we put all the ballot stuffing aside, the swing against Trump in these Rust Belt states in the American heartland from these rural working class white voters, especially men, was like 2 or 3 percentage points. It was big enough to cost him some of those states where the people who put him into office didn't come back the second time around because he didn't really deliver for them. They felt like he did not deliver well enough for them. And it seems like he's coming back again, taking that seriously and showing them that he's taking that seriously, that he's learned his lesson and that he does want to make sure that he's delivering completely for them. And that's where it looks like Vance will be an asset to Trump with those voters. And I saw it reported in an Axios left-wing publication that they think that Vance may even help with suburban women, who Trump is considered to struggle with notoriously. And even though Vance himself is a Christian, socially conservative, I saw them claim that if the suburban women watch the Hillbilly Elegy movie, so they did a movie adaptation of his book. I haven't seen it, so I can't make a recommendation, but I'm just saying that I've seen the left-wing media report that if suburban women watch this movie, then they will like J.D. Vance. So you can, clearly he will have some appeal to the voters that Trump has basically been struggling with the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think just going back to Biden doing better in those Midwest states, Biden actually has some appeal with those types of voters as well. Because he's an old white guy, is a classic social democrat. And so that's part of the explanation, I think, for Biden doing better and Trump doing better, Trump doing relatively worse in those, although Trump increased his vote as well overall. But Biden doing, that's part of the explanation for Biden doing relatively better. But another one is that the so-called get out the vote effort among the inner city blacks in those swing states was incredible, almost beyond belief. He got huge turnout rates of near 100% in these inner city black communities in the big urban centers. And this, you know, spurred a lot of the, you know, the thinking about that voter fraud and that sort of thing. Because there's a lot of tricks they sort of pull. That, you know, they go and they take the voter forms around to these people's places. They ship them off. They give them a nice meal. They tell them who to vote for. The same thing that some of our friends, you know, John Tamahiri and crew, it's been revealed that they've been doing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The Manuela Marais scandal. So that's
very familiar.
They're sort of importing this what's been done in America for a long time.
There's an outfit in America. It's called Tammany Hall. And that was 100 years ago, I think. And that was, they were doing that 100 years ago. And so it's been happening for a very long time.
Yeah. It's a wee bit dishonest. And, you know, especially with the mail-in voting change, it just makes those sorts of things much easier to happen. And that they really need to tidy up that mail-in voting thing.
So a few states have tidied that up, but yeah, we will have to wait and see how that election turns out. Now, one of the things that the elites that I've been talking about recently, the PayPal mafia, as we often refer to them as, and they've sort of earned that name, the founders and early employees of PayPal, very, very wealthy, and they're lovingly called the PayPal mafia. And one of their members, Peter Thiel, and I'd forgotten his name earlier on in the show, but he's the honorary New Zealander, bought a New Zealand passport. And he bankrolled J.D. Vance's senatorial campaign. So Peter Thiel, venture capital, PayPal connection, friend of Elon Musk, he's been bankrolling Vance. And he's also going to be continuing to do that for Trump. So you can see that he's got some of these younger, wealthier men behind him who want to make sure that they've got someone who can advocate for their interests as well, but who can obviously speak to rural America and who can sort of turn things around on the right wing. And one of the other men who has been bankrolled by Thiel in the sort of, I guess, ideological space is a man by the name of Curtis Yarvin. And Yarvin and Vance are known to be good friends as well. And Yarvin used to post online under a pseudonym, Mencius Moldbug was his name. And he sort of got famous by writing an open letter to progressives. And I won't be able to detail very much of Yarvin's ideology here, but it is usually referred to as neo-reactionary theory. So if you hear the term neo-reactionary theory, that's connected with Yarvin, connected with Vance, connected with Thiel. And it's very, very popular among millennials and Zoomers on the right and conservatives and even more libertarian types as well. And it sort of is a theory around political power that the elites shape the political reality. And so it's not really the people, like democracy isn't really run by the people. It's not really run by the little guys. It's actually run by people with a lot of money and a lot of power. And it's a shift of thinking on the right about the need to have elite people in positions of power to be able to make changes. If I'm just trying to sum this up in a really simple way for listeners who may not be familiar with these ideas, I'm happy to pass this over to you, William, to comment on. But one of Yarvin's ideas is what he calls the cathedral, which is basically that both the left-wing and right-wing political party are part of the same power structure compared to like a medieval cathedral. That's why he calls it the cathedral, as that was sort of the central political power structure in the medieval town. And whether or not it's the left-wing or the right-wing supposedly in charge, they just rotate round their inner and outer circle of the same power structure. And that it's basically impossible for people on the outside to break that power structure unless they're actually stronger than the cathedral itself. He doesn't really talk much about solutions. That's where his support for Vance comes from. And now they're trying to shift that into, okay, well, how do we apply this theory and actually make political change?
Yeah. So, I mean, Curtis Yarvin's had significant influence, I think, on the online right. The idea of the cathedral, I mean, he's memed that into existence, into the minds of, you know, political analysts on the right. The cathedral really is the structure in society, the institutions in society that shape the way people think. So the mainstream media and academia, basically the cathedral. And it's called the cathedral because drawing a comparison, I think, with the Catholic Church in medieval Europe, which, you know, set the cultural and the moral tone and the structure, the belief systems of the ordinary people. So he's saying that the media and academia now structure the way people think in the same way that Catholic Church did in medieval Europe. And if you can structure the way people think through political correctness, for example, as we talked about earlier in the program, if you can structure how people think, you control how they think, you can control how they vote by saying what forms of thought are acceptable and which ones are off limits, defining what's moderate and what's extreme. All that sort of behavior shapes the way people vote, and it can ultimately ensure who wields power and who doesn't, and the type of society that you live in. So it's what has been an analysis of power and power relations is something the left has traditionally done very well. Well, not traditionally, but in modern times, the last 50 to 100 years, something the left has been very good at, but the right has been woefully lacking in. Conservatives for the last 50 years or more have tended to think about abstract principles and, thought in very sort of moral terms. If you think about the way libertarianism works, it's a sort of moral theory about, you know, what's right and wrong. It's right to let people make their own decisions as long as they're not harming third parties. It's not really a structural analysis of how power works, who wields power, how they get into positions of power, and how they implement the types of policies and types of society they want to achieve. And that's the difference that Curtis Yarvin and the neo-reaction ideology makes. It's a more practical way of thinking that helps you actually bring about real change in the real world, rather than thinking about what the change ought to be in an ideal world. More Machiavellian, if you read the introduction to The Prince. Machiavelli talks about the difference between real principalities and imagined ones, and how he's going to talk about real ones rather than previous thinkers who talked about imaginary ones. So that's why it's important, I think.
Definitely something Machiavellian is that he's brought in a positive way. Now, and like use Machiavellian, that was Machiavelli's entire thesis was around how to have a positive impact and how the prince should be a positive figure, but how that sometimes might involve people from the outside saying, oh, those things are not very nice, but that ultimately they're necessary for the greatest amount of good to be able to be exercised by a Christian prince. And a lot of the ideas introduced in neo-reactionary theory as well come from a German jurist by the name of Carl Schmitt as well. And I've seen many arguments that the left basically operates on the principles that Carl Schmitt put forward. Ultimately, you know, what matters is power. And then, you know, arguing, as you've just said, arguing about, oh, well, this is what the moral thing should be, this is what the law should be. It's really about the exercise of power. And basically, Yarvin is trying to introduce that idea to the right wing. And you're seeing someone now in the United States at a very high level, vice presidential candidate, who sort of subscribes to that way of thinking, which is theoretically a more successful way to deal with political change and to have the focus on how to acquire power and how to use it to benefit your people, the people who are supporting you and the people who are your friends, essentially. And that's what's going to be the thing that Vance brings to the table for the people who have been watching him on the sidelines for the last few years.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I can't actually speak to I've never heard J.D. Vance talking about neo-reactionary theory, but I mean, if assuming he has these associations, I mean, he must have some familiarity with it. And if you look at all these things happening in the background, like we've discussed earlier, the 2025 project and the what the Heritage Foundation is doing there, the focus on getting people into positions of power to make a difference, the talk about having this, you know, and the practice of having this counter-elite, which, you know, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and people like this would be a part of. It certainly looks as if people are thinking and acting in that way. So
I'll just quickly read out this interview that he did recently, because you said, does he speak like this? Well, here's a quote from him on an interview where he said, "I think that, you know, we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left. What we need is a de-bathification program, a de-wokeification program," referring here to the, I guess, the deconstruction of the Iraqi regime. And he said this is before he was, you know, this is, I think, from last year, because he said, "I think Trump is going to run again in 2024. And what I think that Trump should do, if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, and replace them with our people." And then he says, "When the courts try to stop you, you stand before the country and say," quoting Andrew Jackson, "the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it." So that's from DJ Vance. And he says, he follows this up with, "We are in a late Republican period," and the author says here, "evoking the common new right view of America as Rome awaiting its Caesar." Going back to quoting Vance here, "If we're going to push back against it, we're going to have to get pretty wild and pretty far out there and go in directions that a lot of conservatives right now are uncomfortable with," end quote. So that's the way that he speaks in interviews. So I think that does line up with what we've been talking about.
You're right, it does, yeah. I once heard Curtis Yarvin give a presentation about the RAGE principle, R-A-G-E, retire all government employees, where he argued that the first day the president gets into office, he should sign an executive order to get rid of all the people. So this is very much in line with the way this type of thinking goes.
All right, well, I think that's about it for dealing with the American issues. It's only taken us about 50 minutes, so that's not too bad. I do think this was the bulk of what happened this week, so I don't feel bad committing almost the entire weekly roundup to it. But if you've got anything that you think I've omitted to raise on this, or you're happy for me to move on to talk about Christopher Luxon.
Now let's move on.
So Luxon was at the NATO summit in the past week, and he made a couple of comments about our relationship with China and America. This is somewhat relevant, I think, as well to Trump's foreign policy. And Luxon basically said that he wants to call out China for spying more often, because, you know, New Zealand's been very timid with regards to that. He also wants to be able to sign a deal with the Philippines and deploy more military assets from New Zealand to the Philippines. He also wants to join the US and Australia in conducting joint military exercises, and really sees New Zealand being a force multiplier for Australia and the United States. So he wants to very openly now realign ourselves with NATO, with the United States, with Australia. He's dedicated over $130 million to Ukraine and reaffirmed his commitments, New Zealand's commitments to supporting Ukraine. And this has resulted in Helen Clark and Don Brash being quite unhappy with the China comments in particular, that they say this threatens New Zealand's independent foreign policy, and they don't like him allying us so openly with the United States. Yeah. Now, I guess, yeah, I'd be keen to hear your comments on that.
Well, as we've sort of discussed before, I mean, I see the world, we're moving from the age of America being the world's sole superpower back towards an age of geopolitical competition. And I see basically a US and NATO-led Western bloc against a Russia and China-led Eurasian bloc, and those being the two big geopolitical centers of power. And it looks as if America, UK, NATO are trying to rope in other allies, including in the Pacific, which is our region, to try and counterbalance Chinese influence in the area. And it looks like they're courting Luxon. Luxon is responding, or is willing to try and move ever so slowly, ever so carefully, more towards closer security relationships with their traditional allies, the US and NATO. Well, kind of NATO is a traditional ally, kind of, but the US, UK, and Australia. So that's how I see it going. They're trying to have it both ways a little bit, the government. I think they're trying to move closer to the US while trying to say, oh, no, we're still kind of independent, floating in between here. And if you were going to try and move closer to the US, it probably is wise to do it that way, because we are still reliant on China. It's our biggest trading partner. And it's a lot, especially for our agricultural exports, and they take a large proportion of those. So we do have to be very careful with that relationship. But yeah, I mean, it's an open question for me whether the move to align ourselves more with the US, Australia, UK, NATO is really the wise move or the move we should be making. And, you know, and I would have been more open and supportive of a move in times gone by, but the way things are right now, I mean, I have pretty serious questions about the leadership of the US and NATO, the governing institutions, whom I see as not necessarily governing in the best interests of their own people. So while I feel some sort of fellow feeling and some commonality with the people of the US and Europe, I'm not sure that the governments and the institutional power really accurately represents them.
Yes, on that subject, moving over to the European Union, it was revealed this week as well by Elon Musk, again, in more detail, because he has talked about it before, but they united, the European Union offered him a deal to censor people, which they had been demanding, and he had spoken openly about this before. So they came back to him and said, okay, how about you censor these people quietly without telling anyone, and then we'll let you off the hook. So you don't have to publicly comply, but if you go and privately comply with our request to censor these people, then we'll leave you alone. And so you see the European Union basically still doubling down on its censorship efforts, even when it's confronted very openly, as they have been by Elon.
Yeah, very censorious, very bad for freedom, those sorts of moves. But the improvement that I see there is that this is really the sort of thing that the Twitter files and those revelations told us was happening beforehand anyway. It's just we were never being told about it before. But now it feels like we're getting more information about these deals being proposed and being made. So that in itself is progress, I think.
And then another piece of free speech, at least an issue around free speech, the Compact magazine has been banned in Germany. Its offices were raided just a few days ago. And I'm not sure if they arrested the printers or the editors of the magazine, but they definitely properly raided their houses, and they basically banned the magazine itself from Germany. What is in the Compact magazine? What's so special about it? Is it that much of a threat to Germany? They basically banned it as a threat to national security.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a so-called far-right magazine. Really, I mean, it talks about itself as being a defender of German sovereignty, using this sort of language. But the issue, the reason that they've banned it, and it's been removed completely from the internet.
Yeah.
The reason they've banned it.
Completely based in Germany, right? So they just nuked it, just gone.
It's gone. Yeah. And they raided all the people's offices, took their hard drives, all this sort of thing. Their magazine had an editorial line that they had an ethnic definition of what a German person was, right? So that they're defining what it means to be German in ethnic terms. And the argument from the minister from the interior, I think her title was, I can't remember her name off the top of my head. She seems to be arguing that something along the lines of defining a German person in ethnic terms is a breach of the German constitution in some sort of way, because the German constitution defends the rights of minorities and ensures you're not allowed to discriminate against minorities. So they're calling the behavior of the magazine unconstitutional on those grounds, and it's all around this ethnic definition of what a German is. And this has been criticized, and this is obviously a huge deal for free speech. It's a massive censorship undertaking.
It's been reported as the greatest action taken against the free press in Germany since World War II. I think the first time they've just straight up banned an entire segment of the free press, really.
It's very ironic that we're going to save Germany from Nazis by behaving exactly like Nazis and censoring all our political opponents and, you know, acting like the secret police and raiding them and taking them away.
So in a little bit, when I looked at this, I saw one of the possible justifications given that they were a little bit pro-German, or they had a Marxist, it was kind of supposed to be about conservatives and Marxists who are both running the magazine as well. It sounded a little bit funky. I don't know if it's something that you know on that particular angle, whether or not there was any connections there with supposedly connections to Marxism and to Russia.
I haven't looked into it in depth, but it's a pro worker conservative magazine. So it has some things in common with, we were just talking about populism in the US. Mm-hmm. So it's less of the free market conservatism, more of the pro-worker conservatism.
Well, thank you for that. And locally in free speech issues as well, we've had a few positive developments, at least one positive development, I think, from the Otago University have actually issued a statement on free speech. I hope you came across this. I mean, this is really your area of interest. So what do you think of the University of Otago's free speech statement?
Well, I think it's a very positive and strong statement in defense of free speech and academic freedom. And it's really good that we're getting this sort of thing, because a lot of New Zealand's universities have been less than optimal in this area. If you need free speech anywhere and the ability to make arguments, and no matter how unpopular or frowned upon or disliked, if you need that ability anywhere in order to drive the production of knowledge forward, it's in the university. Universities are really the engines of much of what we call progress. And I know people on the right often...
no progress. We don't want any of that.
idea of progress. But progress can mean different things. So there's social progress, but there's also scientific, technological, and economic progress. And those latter three, I think, are types of progress that people on the right can embrace. Things, you know, the accrual of scientific knowledge is something that happens, as long as you don't destroy the, you know, burn all the books or, you know, take down the internet, destroy the places where, burn all the libraries, destroy the places where knowledge is stored, then... Or refuse to educate people so that the knowledge can be transferred and learned, then the potential exists for the knowledge to accumulate and accrue and grow and build upon itself, such that, you know, our technology and our economy and material standards of living can continue to grow and improve, so long as that process is allowed to continue. But that requires free speech and the ability to challenge ideas. You can't overturn existing scientific paradigms, existing ways of understanding the world, if you get burned at the stake when you suggest them. And so it's important to allow free speech for that reason, so that, because often new and revolutionary ideas, they come from heretics, and you need to have some sort of tolerance for the heretics and ability for them to put their ideas forward in order for new understandings to emerge and take hold and make everyone's lives better.
Now, there's also been a few, I guess, arguments, debates back and forth on neutrality, political neutrality in the university. And I guess it'll be interesting to hear from you how that interacts with freedom of speech. So there have been, a number of issues on the university campus, especially recently around the Treaty of Waitangi, around Gaza, several protests, and, you know, whether or not there has been censorship there in the New Zealand universities, I'm not 100% familiar on, but I see that debate escalating whether or not, you know, these universities should be politically neutral, or were, whether it's a restriction on their freedom of speech to argue that they should be neutral in a sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a sort of sleight of hand going on there, allowing the university itself to take a position versus the people within the university.
Exactly. Yeah.
Being able to take a position.
I had the answer as soon as I asked the question. I thought, oh well, yeah, the university. That's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
But the Treaty of Waitangi would be the big thing there. So, and this is a similar problem to what we saw with the mainstream media in New Zealand as a result of the Public Interest Journalism Fund, where they tried to sneak in adherence to the treaty and treaty principles in various ways as a condition of receiving public interest journalism fund money. And the problem with that is that the treaty is a live political issue, which you have people on various sides of the debate on. And the media is unable to remain neutral and report both of those sides fairly if they've signed up to some agreement that requires them to take a particular line on it. And that way of thinking also goes for the universities. How can they remain neutral towards people who are skeptical of the treaty, who make arguments that we ought to abolish the treaty or that we shouldn't use the treaty principles? Now, these are all legitimate points of view that have their merits or their dismerits. But in a university, you should be able to make those arguments at the very least. And it makes it very difficult to make those sorts of arguments if the treaty is sort of embedded in and is an expectation of your work and your research and the way your educational courses are run and all these sorts of things.
Well, that's just about it for this week. We are out of time, and well, we're actually a bit over time in terms of the target here, but there has been so much to talk about this week. It has been one of those weeks in politics where sometimes it feels like a year's worth of stuff has happened. I'll just mention on the treaty obligations here as well, we did have a development this week there that David Seymour ordered Pharmac to remove their treaty obligations, and or at least consideration of it in whatever documents that they use to claim that they need to review treaty obligations and in how they order medicines. I'm not even sure how that was supposed to work, but again, I don't think it was supposed to work. I think it's just supposed to be bureaucratic nonsense to allow them to spend money and rearrange power for nefarious ends. So there is some development there in terms of that promise that the coalition agreement has, that you know all of that treaty stuff is going to be removed from the remits of these government departments, and that allows them to do all kinds of effectively really like censorship of dissent in terms of personnel, I think, just like the universities do. They use it as a sort of a litmus test of who's allowed to hold a certain position in the same way that perhaps pronouns and other elements of the diversity, equity, inclusion programs are used to sort of keep conservatives out of key positions. So it's just great to see that development happen as well. That's going to be it. Thank you for joining me on the show this week, William. And we will look forward to chatting with you again. There won't be a roundup next week, but we will be back in the first week of August.
Thanks, Dewa.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer. Politics, power, and culture. Right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
There is an interesting piece of history that I might leave you with. The 13th of July, the day of the attempted assassination of the Republican leader and presidential candidate Donald Trump, happened exactly 88 years to the day after the assassination of Spanish politician José Calvo Sotelo by communist thugs. That assassination was the key event in sparking what quickly became known as the Spanish Civil War. Many people are drawing parallels between the Spanish Civil War and the social bifurcation of America, including reading list recommendations given out by Elon Musk. My own personal favorite book on the Spanish Civil War is Mine Were of Trouble by Peter Kemp, an English Protestant who fought for Franco and later on went to become a founding member of British Special Forces in World War II. And if we think back 88 years ago, the history that could have been and has been avoided in America this week. Now it is time for a short mailbag. My wife, Amy, should be back next week, but once again, I will handle a few pieces of feedback here. There are two items from last week's roundup. Peter writes back on the implication of genocidal speech in South Africa. Excellent program. If you live on a farm or lifestyle block in South Africa, the implication of kill the farmer, kill the boer are anything but vague. Anyone who doubts this would only need to spend 1 or 2 weeks on a remote South African farm for a reality check. End quote. Absolutely right, Peter. And the fact that this isn't considered to be a cause of violence is a black mark on that country. I think that it's a far more relevant crossing of the line than many other examples that get brought up. Grant writes in with regards to immigration numbers tightening up, and I quote, "I can confirm that the government has indeed clamped down on immigration. My sister is an immigration advisor in Auckland and is in the process of reconfiguring her business as it becomes less viable to rely on immigration as her main source of income. She even has some immigrants to work on resident visas that are being sent home," end quote. Yes, we should cover that side of the story one day, and it is probably going to become more relevant to economic and employment numbers later on in the year and early next year. The unemployment rate is going to go up, but a lot of these job losses might be connected with visas, and so we'll probably see an increasing number of immigrants being sent home to relieve pressure here. And that's another unintended consequence of the very lax and liberal policies that we have had on immigration, harmful to both sides of the equation. Thank you for all of the other feedback as well. I appreciate all of the comments, but we are out of time for today. On behalf of the RCR team, thank you for spending another week listening to and interacting with all of our shows. The replays will start at 4 p.m. and continue on until breakfast returns on Monday at 7 a.m. But with Paul Brennan away next week, there is going to be a special program with other hosts taking over the breakfast shows. More information should be in your inbox about that if you are subscribed. And of course, if you're a foundation member, if you're listening here and you're not a member of RCR, highly recommend you join now. I won't be part of the special program next week, but I will be back in the first week of August. The final piece of music this week is the Three Old Viennese Dances by Sergei Rachmaninoff, played here by Edel Buret. And that is all from Reality Check Radio for this week. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon, your evening, and your weekend.
Thanks for tuning in to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer. You can catch The Dialogue replays on our website at www.realitycheck.radio/replays.